See, they couldn't do stuff like that, and then I got to get up and follow that. That's just not right. You know, we ought to figure something out there. But appreciate that. Y'all bear with me. You know, when Pam and I were in high school in the summertime, we would be counselors at a Christian camp. We did this 4 or 5 years. It's a Christian Summit Lake camp up above the mountains of Emmitsburg and stuff. And kids would come for a 2-week session. And they do horseback riding and archery and hiking, camping and stuff like that, you know, boating and fishing. And so each senior counselor, that's what we were in charge of a cabin that housed 12 to 15 kids. And we did everything all day long with those kids. We ate with them and you know, walked around with them all day long and stuff. And in the mornings, we do a morning Bible study. In the evenings, we do a Bible study devotion. And each night after supper, there was a worship service. Everybody went to a worship service where we'd lead them in some raucous singing, and then a guest pastor would be there for the entire session and would deliver a message. Now, parents, you know how hard it is to get your kids to be quiet during a sermon, right? You aren't really expecting them to listen to the sermon. You just want them to, you know, let you catch a word or two maybe and not be distracting to everybody around. So imagine that with not just two or three or four kids or whatever, but with 12 or 15 kids that you've got to, you know, keep quiet during the message. And then imagine doing that in a large, unair-conditioned, what they called tabernacle, with a couple of hundred other kids. And somewhere along the line, I'm thinking, who thought this was a good idea, you know? But that's what we did. Now some of the kids wanted to be there. They wanted to be a part of this camp. And some kids, you know, didn't necessarily choose this, but they put up with it. And then there were those kids who were there because their parents needed a 2-week break, you know. So they paid for them to go away to summer camps. And these are the kids who wore you out as a counselor. Some of the kids came from economically distressed situations. Some of them came from emotionally stressed families, maybe broken homes and things like that. And some came from a combination of those things. And there's this one kid that I'll never forget. His name was Kevin. I know his last name, but I'm not going to give it because, you know. But I remember him. He's one of those kids that you don't forget. Because he was one of those kids who plucked not only your last nerve, but the second to the last nerve. And then the one before that pretty much plucked all of your nerves. All right? He was one of those oppositionally defiant kids who wouldn't do anything that he was supposed to do without some kind of a struggle. But the thing is that he wasn't angry or sullen or depressed or anything. That's not why he did this. He didn't come from a place where his mother's boyfriend beat him, or you know, he wasn't bullied at school or whatever. He did it because it was fun. This was entertainment, trying to see what he could get away with, having a teenage counselor chasing him around, yelling at him, and trying to get him to line up with the other kids. This was entertainment. You tell him to do something, and he'd find a way not to do it, and then just laugh. And there were no consequences I could come up with, no punishments that you could come up with that would break you. He would just laugh. There was one time, literally, out of frustration, I don't recommend this, but out of frustration, I picked him up and put him against the wall and got in his face. And I was a big dude. I weighed all of 145 pounds back then, you know. And put him against the wall, and he laughed the whole time. The more physical I got with him, the funnier he thought it was going to be. I don't know how I didn't kill him, but I didn't, you know. I'm convinced that I could have waterboarded him, and then after he caught his breath, he would have laughed, you know. One day, one of my things came up missing from my cabin. Cabins were all unlocked. Anybody could go in there. And something came up missing. It was a little alarm clock, a little analog thing that my dad had gotten for business trips. There was a time when motels didn't have, you know, alarm clocks in every room and stuff chained down. So my dad brought his own, and I had taken it to use, and someone had taken it from my stuff. So I looked around and couldn't find it, and I asked some of the other counselors to be on the lookout for it. A day or so later, one of the junior counselors came up to me, and apparently he had done an illegal, warrantless search of Kevin's belongings, and he found my dad's clock in Kevin's stuff, or at least what was left of it, because it was kind of all broken up and in various pieces. But he didn't just bring the clock to me, he brought Kevin to me, right? Had Kevin by the scruff of his neck, and Kevin wasn't laughing. Because I had him. I knew it, he knew it, the junior counselor knew it. And he knew he was in trouble. He knew he was probably going to get sent home, and who knows what might happen then, but it wouldn't be anything that he didn't deserve. He earned every bit of it. And for some reason, though, I didn't feel angry at him. And I didn't feel triumphant that I'd finally gotten one over on him. No, the overwhelming feeling that I had in that moment was sadness. It was disappointment. And I'm not saying that in that moment that I was some kind of a saint or anything, you know. If Kevin had been unrepentant and defiant in that moment, I'm laughing in my face, I'm sure I would have nailed him as much as I could have, but he wasn't. When I looked at him, what I saw was shame and fear, genuine fear. And you know what? That's not a good look on anybody, no matter how guilty they are. So I found myself looking at the clock and explaining to Kevin this wasn't mine, it was my dad's and everything. And then I just looked at the junior counselor and just said, let him go. And the junior counselor was like, what? Are you nuts? You know? And I'm like, yeah, let him go. And the look on Kevin's face changed. I didn't see fear and shame. It all changed to astonishment in many ways. And I didn't walk away from there feeling like anything had really changed between us. But it had. From that moment to the end of camp, Kevin was a changed kid. He stopped being so defiant. And if he needed correcting, I just needed to say something, and he would get back in line and stuff, you know. And then he would talk to me like a normal kid, and actually found out he's kind of funny, and we'd share some laughs with each other. And you know what? He came back the next year. He was in somebody else's cabin, gratefully, but he was still a changed kid. And eventually came back as he got older. He came back and was a counselor himself. And I thought about that, and I reflect back on the moment, and it's like it was the first time I realized how really, really powerful grace is. How really powerful forgiveness is. How unconditional love in all of its expressions can truly change a person's life. You see, if I had nailed Kevin in that moment when I had the opportunity, when I was justified, if I had pursued punishment out of my anger and out of a sense of retribution and maybe even revenge, if I had done that, I might have changed Kevin's behavior. But the lesson he would have learned is that if you're going to steal something, don't keep the evidence. That would have been the only thing he would have learned. It might have changed his behavior if I'd punished him. But it wouldn't have changed his heart. Something's greater if you're going to change the human's heart. And changing the human heart is the only thing God is really interested in. There's a tendency to think that love is a love's a nice thing to have when things are going well, when things are nice and people are acting nice to each other. But when problems face us, when real problems, the kind of problems we see in our world today, when they face us, when tyrants of questionable mental health are building nuclear missiles, and when teenagers are shooting up classmates, and when strong men are hacking our elections, and terrorists are strapping bombs on themselves in the name of religion and killing innocent people, when these kinds of problems face us, loving will take care of this. Something more is needed. That's our tendency. That's our belief. Something stronger, something more immediately effective, something more aggressive, something more forceful. Because in those kinds of situations, in those kinds of times, who's got time for love? Love's too passive and weak in those kinds of situations. In these kinds of situations, love will get you killed. And that's just dumb. Right? And when you come to that conclusion, you realize, hopefully, that you just called Jesus dumb. I mean, do you think that Jesus lived in a time that was any less violent, any less corrupt than the times that we live in? I mean, the Jewish religious leaders were willing to knowingly murder an innocent person to protect their power and to enforce their doctrines. The Romans used terrorism to try to control unruly populations like the Jews. One time they crucified over 500 Pharisees in one day. The roads were literally lined with dead and dying bodies and birds picking at them. Just as an example of Rome's power and ruthlessness to the population, it was terrorism. And by the way, crucifixion as a means of controlling unruly populations proved to be an utter failure. It just entrenched the hatred that the Jews had for their Roman oppressors, and eventually led not to just one, but to two uprisings within 100 years of each other against Rome. They were an utter failure. Utter failure. And that's because using a sword or a gun or a missile can't change a human heart. And that's what's needed in situations like this. And we see this in the Old Testament. In the Exodus story, for instance. In the Exodus story, Pharaoh's heart is hardened, and God tries various forms of coercion to get him to let the Hebrew slaves go free. Turn the Nile into blood and sent plagues to frogs and flies and locusts, and still Pharaoh's heart was hard. He afflicted the entire population with boils, and still Pharaoh's heart was hard, and sent lice and darkness, and still Pharaoh's heart was hard. And even when God killed all the firstborn of Egypt, including Pharaoh's very own son, Pharaoh's heart was still hard. Sure, he let the people go. Then he sent an army after him, remember? He let the people go, but his heart hadn't changed. And heart change is what's needed in a situation like this. Back in Genesis 6, the flood story, God decides he's going to destroy all living things on the earth because violence filled the earth and the heart of the human was evil all the day. So God sent a flood and he killed everything and everybody with just a few remnants on this ark. And when it was all over, what did God say? I ain't never going to do that again. That's my translation, right? But that's what he says. I'm never going to do that again. And you know why? Because the heart of the human is evil all the day. In other words, he'd committed this great act of killing, of coercion, of force, and the human heart was still evil all the day. Something else is needed. Something else was needed. So Jesus comes and he does something different. And he does something so much more powerful. Jesus wields love and grace and forgiveness. Yeah. And I use that word intentionally. He wields it. It's not just something that he has and he shows. He utilizes love and grace and forgiveness as, if you will, a weapon, as an intentional strategy to expose the forces of darkness for the darkness that they are and to change the human heart. He wields them. He refuses to form an army or pick up a sword. He refuses to call down a legion of angels and an act of power against those who had killed him. And for anybody who thinks that love and grace and these kinds of things are just too weak and too passive, Jesus was anything but passive, right? Especially the days leading up to the cross, Jesus is anything but passive. He's not just sitting around teaching, minding his own business when they come and arrest him. He's provoking them. He's confronting them. He's not up there hiding in an upper room. He was in the upper room, but then he says, "Let's go down where they can find me." He cleanses the temple. He challenges the religious leaders. He stands before Pilate silent and defiant, not offering up a word of defense for himself. In the moment that they nailed him to the cross, the moment he looked down from his cross and said, "Father, forgive them," rather than call down that army of angels, in that moment, he won. He won. Love won. Grace won. Forgiveness won. In that moment, he breathed his last. He won. And one of the Roman soldiers who had crucified Jesus looked up at him and he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." And in that moment, another human heart had changed. The cross is the victory of life over death, of love over power, of grace over revenge. And the resurrection, that which we celebrate today, that is the vindication of Jesus' choice and his life. It is only through the cross of Jesus that resurrection comes to us. When the perishable puts on imperishable and the mortal body is raised to immortality. It is because of the cross and the victory that was won there, and the resurrection that demonstrates that this kind of life has God's approval. Because of that, that Paul is able to say, "Death, where is your victory? Where is your sting? You've lost." Thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. See, love. This kind of love is not passive at all. It is a powerful force to be wielded. It doesn't always take effect as quickly as a sword does. Sword, you pretty much get immediate effect, right? Love doesn't take as quick an effect as a sword does. With love, we're playing the long game. And we're playing the hard game. And it truly takes a tough person to stay with it and not succumb to the easy way of forcing your will and your desire and your beliefs on another person. And that's why Paul says there at the end, "Therefore, my beloved, be steadfast, be immovable, always excelling in the work of the Lord, because you know that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." Because in the end, the only kind of love that will crawl up on a cross and be raised from the dead, that is the only thing that can change the human heart. I think it's so appropriate that on Resurrection Day, that on Easter Day, that we gather around the Lord's table. Amen? That we celebrate Jesus' sacrifice of his body and his blood, knowing that we could not celebrate a thing if Jesus was still dead. The only reason we do this and we remember his death is because he is still alive. And he sits at the right hand of God the Father. And he's coming back to claim his own. Not just his people, but his kingdom, His will being done on earth as it is in heaven. So let's bow our heads for just a few moments and take a moment right now in the silence of your own heart and your mind to thank the Lord for the victory that Jesus won for us on the cross, for the resurrection that vindicates the faith that Jesus placed in you, in God. And that same kind of faith that will lead us to the resurrection, to new life, to the mortal putting on immortality. As you reflect, let us gather around the table.